Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Fleet Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, we've got Chris Butt with us on the podcast to talk about his new book, The Four Cornerstones of Financial Well-Being. Chris is the founder of the Institute for Financial Well-Being and the chairman of Ovation Finance. He is the author of the best-selling The Financial Well-Being book, which is part of Fleet's Concise Advice series. Chris's new book, The Four Cornerstones of Financial Well-Being, presents an understanding of our finances that is defined not in terms of wealth or status, but by your happiness. It provides practical advice on how to create a financial well-being plan that will help you focus away from simply accumulating wealth and instead focus on enjoying your life. So thank you very much, Chris, for joining me today on the Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your latest book, The Four Cornerstones of Financial Well-Being. So my very first question to you is, why did you decide to write the book?
Well, I have been in the world of money all my life. My degree was economics, and then I spent 25 years, I guess, as a financial advisor. And in that time, I met a lot of wealthy people and advised a lot of wealthy people. And I realized after not that long that the relationship between their money and their happiness was not direct. More money did not necessarily mean more happiness. So back in 2015, I decided to write a book on my experiences called The Financial Wellbeing Book. As an aside, I Googled the term financial wellbeing back then, and there were two returns on that Google search. A joke I like to say is that I actually invented the term financial well-being. I just didn't know that two other people invented it before me. Now, I Googled it again recently, and there's over 300 million results on a Google search now. So it's become kind of the thing. So having written the first book, I've researched a lot more about the relationship between money and happiness. And I guess what I'm doing really is just applying that research, that academic research, also religious thinking, etc., philosophy, psychiatry. There's loads of stuff out there about what makes us happy, and I'm applying it to the financial planning process. So that's what the book does. It starts off by explaining why we aren't very good at well-being, at being happy, how money can get in the way of that, and then gives lots of solutions to how we can get a better relationship with money.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I feel we've always heard that money doesn't make you happy, but I think this book explains why, which was very fascinating to read about.
It does, but money can make us happy. So we have to be very careful. Life isn't black and white. If you don't have money for some food and you give him some money and you can get some food, that will make you happy. Of course it will. So it will be silly of us to say that money doesn't make us happy. But it's about each of our relationship between money. That's what we need to explore. It's different for everyone. There are some truths that are true for everyone, but there are also differences for everyone, and that's what we need to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, you say that there are five elements that make up well-being. So could you share with us what those five elements are, and whether finances play a big role in that?
Sure. So the five elements, and of those two entries in my very original search, one of them was a book called Wellbeing, which is produced by Gallup, authors of Raff and Harter. It's a fantastic book. I'd recommend it. And it looks at the areas of our well-being that we can control, that we can make a difference to. And their decades of research by Gallup, and their five areas are career well-being, our social well-being, our physical well-being, our community well-being, which is how we interact with people around us, and our financial well-being. And what I've come to realize of those five areas is that of those five, the only one that doesn't directly add to well-being is financial. So financial is the one that impacts all the others. So that's the important relationship we need to understand and explore, is how can we arrange our money and arrange our lives to make sure that our money is giving us the maximum impact on those four other areas. And of those four other areas, the one that's most important is the quality of our social relationships. Long-term study by Harvard University is just one of the sources for that. So it's about making sure that money doesn't get in the way, because it can also be a barrier of those four other things. So for me, financial well-being is a really broad topic about our relationship between money and happiness, not just about managing our spending, but managing how we use it to impact all the other areas of our lives.
Yeah, that's very interesting to see. But because we mentioned a few times well-being, of course, and then happiness. So could you tell us what's the difference between happiness and well-being, and why is it important to understand it?
I think that there's two ways of looking at that. You could argue it's just semantics and they're really the same thing. The way I tend to think of it, and it's just a useful way of applying words, is that I think of happy and sad as being short term, kind of in the moment, and well-being being long term. So you could also say contentment might be another word for well-being. Now, that's going to come in to be very important, because there's one particular element, which I think we'll talk about in a bit, where the happy, sad, short term and the well-being long term framing will become very important. So that's the way I think of it. Happiness is like trying to balance a chicken on your nose, right? You can do it, just it doesn't tend to last for very long. So well-being is all about living a life of meaning and purpose and of contentment.
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation of well-being. All right, then in the book, you talk about extrinsic and intrinsic motivations. So could you let us know what these are and how they help or hinder our financial well-being?
Yeah, so there's a psychological model called self-determination theory, which I refer to quite a lot. It's all about why we do things, what makes us happy, what motivates us. And there is an explanation of what motivates us is either something that's intrinsic, i.e. it's internal, it's just something we want to do, or something that's extrinsic, something that is done to please other people. So examples of an extrinsic motivation might be meeting a target at work, or it could be buying a big car because you want to impress the neighbours. It's doing something for other people. Whereas an intrinsic motivation is, we could use the phrase meaning and purpose. It's probably hard to explain why you do something. And if it is hard to explain, it's probably an intrinsic motivation. You just feel you want to do it. It just gives you some internal pride. Now, the reason that this is such an important distinction when we apply this to money is because if you see money as the objective, you are likely to be doing it for extrinsic motivations, because you want to get status. The Harvard study that I referred to early on asked 900 or so teenagers many years ago what they thought would make them happy as they went through life, and they overwhelmingly answered money and fame. So these are extrinsic things. The trouble with extrinsic motivations, the trouble with getting your self-worth from other people, is that your happiness always lies the other side of somebody else's approval, which means you're always chasing it. It means you can't ever actually achieve it. Whereas if you are doing something, or you're using your relationship with money is about intrinsic motivations, your self-worth comes from within, from having a life of meaning and purpose, then you're much more in control of your own well-being. And also your well-being will last a much longer time. So one example I give, which is a slightly unsubtle example, but one of the classic tropes of wealth is the big yacht, right? Now, if somebody goes to their financial advisor, financial planner, and says, I would like a cash flow forecast to see if I can afford a big yacht, the old style financial advisor will say, yes, great, let's do it. Whereas a financial well-being orientated advisor will ask, well, when you get that yacht, what will that give you? What's the other side of that? And if the person answers, well, I want it because I want to take it down to South Coast, and where lots of my friends also have yachts and I'm not keeping up with them, so therefore I need to have a yacht for status, and I want to stand on the back of it with a glass of champagne so people can see me. You know, if they were honest enough to answer those things, then that will not make them happy. That will long-term not make them happy. I think of George Michael's classic quote where he said, having money doesn't make you happy, it just gives you different problems. Now, if that same person says, I want the yacht because I always sailed as a kid. I grew up by the sea. I love sailing. My social life is, and my grown-up kids come back from home at weekends because they want to go sailing with me. Now, that's a much more intrinsic motivation. And so the same objective for two different people could make them happy or unhappy. So understanding whether what you're doing is an extrinsic or intrinsic motivation and applying that therefore to your approach to money is a really important building block.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can conclude that happiness and well-being comes from within, from insights, and we can't really rely on someone else to give it to us.
It's exactly. And if we are, and we may not realize it, but then that is unlikely to lead to happiness. Now, of course, we can't go through life all being, you know, Mother Teresa. So we might need, we will go through sometimes where we'll have a bit of this. So it's not black and white. It's about managing your life to make sure that you are living a life. Do you know what? A really good way of summarizing what I'm trying to say here is I used to use the phrase, you need to live a life of meaning and purpose. And I changed one word in that sentence, which is you need to live a life with meaning and purpose. We need to just calm down a little bit here. We can't all go around doing nothing but kindness for everybody else. There's bound to be some sort of extrinsic motivations involved in our lives. But it's about getting the balance right.
Yeah, absolutely. And then another topic that you cover in the book is comparison. And that's, I think, very interesting topic for many people, especially when it comes to money, because especially on social media, we constantly see different influencers showing their glamorous lives, when in reality it might not be so glamorous. So what role does comparison play in our financial well-being?
That's a great quote, very famous quote from Theodore Roosevelt, which is comparison is the thief of joy. There's also another one, and I can't remember who said this. My apologies to them. I should look it up in a minute. Who said that the level of your happiness depends upon its relationship between the happiness of your sister-in-law's husband. So we compare ourselves all the time. Of course we do. We're bound to. But we also can get to choose who we compare ourselves to. And unfortunately, we live in a society, particularly this Western society, where there is vested interest in getting us to compare ourselves to people who are rich. And so the message that's out there is that money equals success and success equals money. Advertising particularly wants us to do this because then we'll want to buy the product. You know, so there's huge amount of, and also, as you say, on social media. We're never going to put our worst day on social media, are we? We put our best day on social media. And so that's what we compare ourselves to, whether we mean to or not. It's just around us all the time. So part of financial well-being is understanding what I call know thyself, understanding what will make you happy. And what's then happening to other people doesn't actually matter. There's lots of psychology on this, but this is also lots of religious texts as well. Buddhism, for example, is very big on this kind of stuff. So this isn't new. And I think this is a really important point to just get out. I kind of think of the whole world of well-being research, if you'll forgive me for a slightly tortured analogy, a little bit like the school disco, right? You walk into the school disco, it's just getting started, and there's lots of pockets of teenagers all standing around with their arms folded, glaring at each other, right? And over there, we've got the academic researchers who are doing amazing research, pointing out what makes us happy. We've got the neuroscientists, which are showing which bits of the brain light up when we're happy or sad when we do certain things. Fantastic. We've got the behavioral finance people over in that corner, glaring at everybody else, saying, well, they're understanding why we do things and the unconscious biases that we have. And then over in the far corner, you've got the Buddhists standing there going, yeah. What, guys, we've been doing this for 2,500 years, you know, so there isn't anything actually new in all of this. It's more reminding ourselves, because we've forgotten how to be happy in many ways. And one of the reasons for that is because we are given forced comparison to things that don't make us happy. So we've got to change that narrative and get a better relationship with money. And really, that's what this is all about.
That's absolutely fascinating. And then another term that you use in the book is well-being junkie, a financial well-being junkie. So could you explain to our listeners what that is?
Yeah, so this is a really good way of looking at your own spending habits. There is, I have to go and explain a bit of theory first, happiness theory, which is called set point theory. And set point theory, if anybody wants to read more about this, the best book I've read on it is Sonia Lyubomirsky's book. I think it's The Myth of Happiness. But the research suggests that we go through life with a set level of well-being. Which, when we get to adulthood, we then each have our own level of well-being. Everybody will be able to think of somebody who, when they walk in the room, they just seem to light it up because they're just so joyful. And other people who just seem happy being miserable, right? We know both those sorts of people. And we don't tend to deviate hugely long-term from that set point. So this is where the happy, sad, and short-term and well-being long-term phrases come in handy, because something might happen that makes us happy and we rise above our set point. But that doesn't tend to last long, so we gravitate back down to our set point. We acclimatise. Likewise, something might make us sad, but we get used to that, we acclimatise, and we revert to our set point. So we oscillate around that set point. Now, when something happens and makes you happy, that's great. You're not going to want to change that, so you just live with it and get used to it. But if something makes us sad, well, that's not nice. So we tend to do something to get over the fact that we're feeling sad. And the thing that we tend to do is we buy stuff. We buy short-term hits of well-being to keep us up to our set level. There's even a term for this, retail therapy. So though I think of us as we're all financial well-being junkies, buying short-term hits of happiness in order to keep us to our set level. And if people don't think that this is real, I'll give you an example. I love my cricket. I went to see my team Gloucestershire play last summer. When I got there, it started to drizzle. Drizzle is the enemy of cricket. And after a while, I gave up about an hour or so. I think the game was called off. And driving home, I stopped off for the record shop and I bought 50 quid's worth of records. And I'm driving back home in my car and I look left at these pile of records and think, I've literally just done the very thing I'm writing about, which is buying myself a short-term hit of happiness. So a couple of tips here for people. Next time you look at something that may be a little bit pricey and you think, oh, I really fancy that, say, I won't buy that today. If I want that in a week's time, I'll buy it then. Give yourself some time to not make a reaction purchase. And if in a week's time you still want it and you can afford it, then great, go for it. Chances are a lot of the time you'll go, actually, I didn't really need that. And it was just being a financial well-being junkie. The other tip is that, and there's lots of this in some of the appendices of the book, there's quite a lot in the appendices that give lots of tips and ideas of how to combat this stuff. And find other ways to get that hit of well-being. It could be a bit of exercise. It could be phoning a friend. There's lots of different things that you can do to give a short-term hit of well-being that's better than being a financial well-being junkie.
Yeah, I think those tips are great. I think it's very easy just to go and buy something for just a quick hit of happiness. So yeah, thanks for sharing those tips. And then in the book, you also speak about biases that sometimes make us make bad financial decisions. So could you share some examples of those biases and some strategies to navigate them?
Yeah, sure. So behavioral finance has been one of the growth areas of research over the last decade or so. It's a really interesting area. And it's been taken from the world of economics and applied to the world of money, which I think is fantastic. There's a big but here. So let me give you some examples and I'll come back to the but. An example might be present bias. So research tells us that we are terrible at connecting with our future selves. We see our future selves as a different person to us. So consequently, saving money is like giving money away to somebody else. As a consequence, we have a present bias. We would much rather have enjoyment now than enjoyment later. This is more prevalent in some than others. So it's a behavioral bias that we all have, but for some, it might lead to poor financial decisions. And that's the key here. Our brains are wired the way that they're wired because of millennia of behaviors that have evolved into certain actions. We've only had to think about our own financial futures really in the last 40 years of the entire existence of humanity. That's because of life expectancy increasing, because of the destruction, I guess that's a slightly dramatic word, but it's probably true, of employer pension schemes. We've been handed the responsibility for our financial futures. It's also because we don't tend to live with our families into old age if we do live past a working age. So for lots of reasons, only in the last 40 years have we been handed the responsibility for our financial futures. as a consequence, the way our brains are wired are kind of fight or flight decisions. You know, I don't want to be eaten by that saber-toothed tiger. I'd better run away. That's how we make decisions about money with our what's called system one. We make gut decisions. So we're just not very good at it as a consequence. And our behavioral biases, therefore, some of them are brilliant because they stop us getting eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. It's the ones that are not very good when it comes to financial planning that we want to be interested in. So I mentioned behavioral present bias. Confirmation bias is quite a well-known one where we seek out information to confirm our existing views. It's why somebody who votes Labour buys a Daily Mirror and somebody who votes Conservative buys a Daily Mail, so that they can get confirmation of their views. Well, that's what we should really be doing, is getting reading papers, go the other way around, reading papers that challenge our views. But that's not what we tend to do. So when it comes to money, what I'm saying, some people may or may not recognise it, but some people might struggle to accept that, let's using that extreme example again, buying that yacht won't make them happy. And they will buy, read the research that tells them that it will, or there isn't any actually, but read, you know, the notice the adverts that will confirm that sort of bias. So the behavioral biases are things that we need to be aware of. And that's the first step in challenging them, and need to recognize when they are leading to poor financial outcomes. That's the key part to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then apart from biases, you also talk about money distractions in the book. So what are some of those distractions and how they prevent us from being happy and fulfilled?
Well, I've talked a little bit about external motivations, extrinsic motivations, and the fact that the world sort of, you look at films like The Wolf of Wall Street or TV shows like The Apprentice or Dragon's Den, there is this narrative out there that money equals happy, that success equals money. So that's the main distraction, external distraction. But we also have internal distractions as well. So this is a fourth of the four cornerstones. Just to remind people, the four cornerstones are the universal truths, what's true of everybody, the know thyself, what's true of you about money, the poor behaviours that we all have, and then there's the poor behaviours that we individually have, what we would call self-limiting beliefs. And the important point here is to understand that just because I believe something to be true doesn't necessarily mean that it is. And again, if that belief is leading to a poor financial outcome, that makes it a self-limiting belief. So in my time as a financial planner, I came across people who would say the stock market isn't for me. Now, that's not reality. That's just something that they believe. Well, where did that come from? Very often it came from because they invested in the stock market at a time when it was high, because that gave them confidence. And that felt good, even though it was the worst time to invest. This is what people generally tend to do, invest when the stock market's high. And then it went down. They didn't like it. So they got out and then formed the belief that the stock market isn't for them. So that isn't the truth. Another one might be, I'm not very good with money. That's not something that has to be the case. It can be changed. And there's loads and loads and loads of these. I don't deserve to be rich is another one you hear often. So these are all, I don't deserve to be poor equally. none of these are real. None of these are true. They are all beliefs that people hold about them. And what we need to do is understand our relationship with money, understand our beliefs. And a way to do this might be to go back to how you make financial decisions. This could be a good exercise with a couple. When was the last significant financial decision that you made? What were the drivers? What were your reasons for making that financial decision? And I'm not suggesting that they're wrong reasons, but just what are they? Have a look at them. Have a chat. Write some of them down. What are your beliefs around money? And then ask yourself, are these beliefs helping me or hindering me? And if there are any that are actually, and by hindering, I mean helping you to achieve well-being in terms of that intrinsic motivations. So you can hopefully see how the four cornerstones work together to create an overall financial well-being plan.
Yeah, definitely. And then apart from the four cornerstones of financial well-being, in the book, you say that there are five pillars of financial well-being. So what are those?
So this comes from the original financial well-being book. So if the four cornerstones are looking at well-being in general, and money's relationship and how money fits in with that, this is to zone in just on financial well-being. And the five areas that we focus on are control of daily finances, so being good with managing your money, the ability to cope with a financial shock. Now, those two are generally speaking, especially places like in the workplace, are generally speaking what a lot of people call financial well-being. For me, they are just two of the five pillars. I would call that being good with just those two is financial resilience, not financial well-being. And the reason that this is such a key little point is because if you are only focusing on managing your money and managing your debt, you're not actually looking at what makes you happy. For example, if you understand the financial well-being junkie principle and it helps your spending habits, then that will help you to manage your money. So we need to look at the relationship between money and happiness as a whole, not just having some tips for debt and budgeting, even though they are really useful. That's not the whole story. So that's two of them. The third is having financial options in life. And we definitely have to admit that having some more money gives you more options. But are you choosing the options that will make you happy? Financial options in life also, for me, means those self-limiting beliefs, because we can create more options without having more money. We can create more options just by having a better relationship with money. Then we have clarity and security for those that we leave behind. This is a really under-noticed area, I think, but just getting your finances in order. Anybody who has elderly parents or has dealt with elderly people will know that as they recognize they're coming to the end of their lives, they want to simplify. This is why older people quite often report higher levels of well-being than younger people, because they focus on what matters to them, which is their social relationships, and they stop trying to accumulate wealth. But it's also could be something as simple as, I'll give you a quick example. My wife is a cancer nurse, and the Penny Bron Cancer Center is a wonderful place where she has worked in the past who help people to live well with cancer. And there was one chap there who was really struggling with his illness. And one week he came in and he just seemed to be in a better mood. And my wife asked him what had happened. And he said that he had changed the ownership of their family car to his wife's name. That was all. But that was a trigger for him to feel that he was sorting things out and that he wouldn't be leaving problems for those he left behind. So that's the fourth. And then the fifth one is a clear path to achieve identifiable objectives. The two parts of that, identifiable objectives, we can talk about those intrinsic motivations. So that needs a lot more research, and that's what we're doing in this second book. And then a clear path is what the first book helps people to do, which is create something called a cash flow forecast. It's a fancy spreadsheet, really. And this is a clear path to identifiable objectives is really financial planning. And that's why somebody should, if they're using a financial advisor, they should use a financial planner who is going to help you not only manage your money, but also to create that clear path with a cash flow, but also help you work out your identifiable objectives. So they should have some knowledge of this financial well-being area. So that's the five pillars of financial well-being.
Mm. Yeah, and you just mentioned financial planning. And in the book, there are some exercises to help people work on their financial well-being plan. But now, for those who are listening to us today, what would be, and this would be my final question for this episode, what are your top tips for anyone just starting to work on their financial well-being plan?
I think the first thing is there's a great line about somebody who asks directions from somebody in the countryside, and they get the response, well, I wouldn't start from here. And I think that is the first thing to recognize, to re-establish your destinations. There's a Chinese proverb, which is every long journey starts with one small step. My question would be, where are you headed? Because if you take that first step in the wrong direction, you're going to end up in the wrong place. So work out what the destination is for you, which means working out what will make you happy. And that's not an easy thing to do. Where does meaning and purpose live in your life? Where could it live in your life? One way of looking at this could be to ask yourself the question, pick a timescale, let's say 5 years. In 5 years' time, imagine yourself sitting down with a cup of tea or a glass of wine, whatever is your choice, and looking back, what will have to have happened for you to feel happy? So imagine yourself in 5 years' time and say, what will have to have happened in the 5 years leading up to then for me to feel, yeah, that was a good 5 years? You could choose a longer term. But look up is the real secret here. A lot of people in my time as a financial planner will be looking at a retirement age of a certain age. I remember a talk given to me when I was in my 20s, and the speaker asked a group of us, when do you want to retire? And somebody put their hand up and said, 65. And he said, OK, you'll probably only say 65 because that was at the time state pension age. Anybody else? And I think I put my hand up and said, 55. And he said, OK, but that's when you can first access your pension. So that's probably why you're saying why. And he then said, do you know what? When I want to retire, in about 10 minutes. That's the honest truth of it. That's when I'd like to retire. Financially, I can't, however. But let's just change the narrative of how we see our lives, what you actually want, what makes you happy. So study the research, understand some of the principles, challenge yourself. It's actually very hard to challenge your own assumptions. So the strongest thing I would recommend is go and engage a financial planner. But of course, I appreciate not everybody can afford that. So if you can afford it, do that. If you can't afford it, start challenging some of your assumptions, start resetting the future, and then start creating those little steps, start taking that first little step to get there.
Thank you very much for those tips. I'm really hoping that they would be helpful for anyone listening to us today. Of course, I urge them to buy the book, The Four Cornerstones of Financial Wellbeing, which has much more about that, how to build your financial wellbeing plan. But thanks very much, Chris, for taking the time today. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Tia. Great fun.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lit Publishing. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.